Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today takes us into the world of paramedics and EMTs. Kevin Hazard writes, "People like to say it takes a certain type of person to do this job, a special person. And they're probably right, just not in the way they think. Medics don't have to be heroic or tough or even good people. They simply have to enjoy the madness. The normal reaction to gunshots or screaming or house fires or someone collapsing in a messy heap is to get away, to back off, not necessarily to ignore it perhaps, but not to stumble in half-cocked. And really, aside from a driver's license and a high school diploma, that's what this job takes, a willingness to walk in unprotected when we clearly should walk away." Hazard spent 9 years as a paramedic for Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, that city's main hospital for the indigent and a trauma center for the region. His book, A Thousand Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back, gives readers an inside look at a role in our medical care system that we often take for granted until we need them to save a life. In it, he recounts the chaos and carnage these professionals encounter, the black humor it engenders, and the wide variance in competency and professionalism within the field. Kevin Hazard is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Kevin Hazard, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Your book, A Thousand Naked Strangers, tells of your time working as an EMT and paramedic in really some of the most busy medical situations in Atlanta. Take us back to the start. What made you want to become an EMT?
You know, there were two events, really, that contributed to it. The first was that when I was in college, I was witness to this horrible accident. I was leading some jet ski tours, and two of the people on the tour crashed into each other. One of them was very badly hurt, and when I pulled up, you know, I was 19, we're floating in 75 feet of water, and I did the only thing that bystanders are asked not to do in the event of emergency, and I panicked. And that sort of stuck with me for a long time afterwards. So you have that, and then you couple it with, I'm working as a reporter for a newspaper after college, and 9/11 happened. And because I had gone to the Citadel, a lot of my friends were in the military. And so they're marching off to Iraq and Afghanistan and being part of this thing that's much greater than themselves. And I just began to wonder, one, you know, am I that guy who panics when people are counting on him? And two, you know, is this really what I want to be doing? Do I really want to be sitting at city council meetings when there's so much more that I could be doing something, you know, where's my moment to do something larger than myself? And so I came across a group of firefighters and paramedics on a story about a tunnel collapse that I wrote. And there was something in them, and it was clear that they had answered both of those questions. And I realized at that moment, well, here's something right here at home that I can do. And I went for it.
So you enrolled in a school that basically teaches people how to be an EMT, correct?
Yeah, you know, EMS is sort of funny in the world of public safety in that because not every provider is specifically a city entity,
right?
You can sort of go to school and kind of find a backdoor way in. You know, for Atlanta, for instance, the 911 contract is held through Grady Hospital, which is the large public hospital and trauma center in Atlanta. So you don't become an Atlanta firefighter to become an Atlanta paramedic. You go to school, and then you try to get yourself a job with one of the services in hopes of gaining enough experience to get hired at Grady. So that's what I did. I signed up for an ENT class at a local community college and took night classes 3 days a week.
And really, the rules, I think every city has its own rules on how ambulance transport and paramedics work. Sometimes they're with the fire department. Sometimes they're a separate service. Sometimes they're a private service. And it sounds like in Atlanta, it's sort of a mixture of the both, where you have this hospital providing EMTs and paramedics, but they're also private services as well.
Yeah, there are, to a certain degree, every city has private services. You know, there are ambulances that will take people to and from appointments, you know, if they live in a nursing home or if they can't drive and they need to lie down during transport. So those kind of exist all over. But, yeah, Atlanta is funny in the way that EMS is set up. It hasn't been entirely swallowed by fire departments as it has in so many places. Because, of course, you know, a fire department is a very expensive thing to run, and an ambulance actually hands out a bill. So a lot of fire departments have sort of swallowed EMS as a the hope of trying to put all the services under one umbrella, but then also trying to generate some revenue.
Right. Now, you went to this community college with a gentleman you called Alan. And tell us a little about Alan.
Yeah, you know, he's, I would say, very representative of that sort of early generation of EMS providers. You know, these guys, it's easy for us to forget that paramedics really did not exist before 1970. And so through the 70s and early 80s, you had these young guys and young women who were trying to invent a career field every day at work. Nobody knew really what to do with them. Nobody knew exactly what they did. And they themselves didn't necessarily know where their job was going. And he was one of those guys. He had started out from the very beginning, and they all have sort of this preacher's zeal to them, you know, because they worked so hard to create this thing that didn't exist. They had to truly believe in the goodness of what they were doing. And he desperately tried to impart that same emotion in us. You know, it meant everything to him to be teaching new EMTs and bringing us into the world. Of course, he was also working a full-time job at a fire department, so he was really busy, and he showed up that first night, and I think, gosh, there must have been 65 of us in that class. You know, it was probably more than he was prepared to deal with, and, you know, it's sort of a strange mixture. We had a 65-year-old retired truck driver in there. We had 19-year-old kids who had been doing nothing since high school. So it was this really strange group of people, unruly, and, you know, he certainly had his work cut out for us, trying to get us, you know, moving in the right direction.
Well, you went through the various classes, and your expectations weren't realistic when you actually got into this class and began to look at what an EMT does, was it?
No, and like a lot of people, I really didn't know exactly what it was. You know, that first night, I flip open my textbook, and there are these photographs of mangled bodies, and I'm beginning to panic, thinking, my God, am I going to be able to, you know, that old feeling came back, and am I going to be able to handle this? And didn't really know what we were going to be doing. And so we start with this training, and you know, you begin to learn very quickly that not everyone is going to be cut out for this, that there are people in this classroom who are going to show up on the first emergency and not be able to do the job. And it really wasn't until we did our ride-along that there was any way to really have any clue. And I did, you know, we one of our first sort of training sessions where they send you with paramedics was with Grady, of all places. I mean, it's one of the busiest EMS services in the country. It covers the city of Atlanta, you know, a lot of very dangerous places. And, you know, here we are, these brand-new EMTs with literally no experience, who haven't finished the course yet, and we're with these guys. And, you know, my first day was sort of this eye-opening experience of sitting next to them and seeing how quickly they worked and how efficiently and how fast everything moved. And, you know, when there's an emergency, things move at a much quicker pace than you're used to, and you know, trying to stay out of their way but also be helpful and get involved. And you know, it was a guy who smashed his car into a tree, and his legs were horribly broken, but he was very high and he was fighting us, which was not something I was prepared for. It never occurred to me that someone would call 911 and then fight the people who showed up, and we had to hold him down and tie him to the stretcher. And I just remember feeling totally inadequate and think there's no way I'm ever going to be able to do this job. It was a shocking reality of what you've gotten yourself into. And of course, at that point, you're 4 months in.
Right. This book documents a whole series of situations like that, where your expectations would be somebody calls 911. You expect them to want to go to the hospital. And in this case, this guy was high and belligerent and horribly injured, yet oblivious to his situation, and is fighting you at every turn. I assume one by one, these sort of misconceptions fell by the wayside.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they told you right away that your training is only going to get you so far, that practicing medicine in the bathrooms of a restaurant or on the side of a highway or an abandoned building, it's not practical to do everything by the book. So step one is to forget 90% of what you've learned and try to relearn it here. And that was, a big surprise. And then just the way that so many of the people approach us, you know, one of the more eye-opening facts was that you can go into these incredibly dangerous areas, and you can be around people that, you know, you begin to learn with some experience what it is to be in the room with a predator. You can just tell dangerous people. You begin to, you know, sort of see their characteristics. And it was shocking how often you would be with someone like that, and they were really helpful and just happy that you were there and glad to begin to help, even though you knew deep down these were probably bad people.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side, of course, was that there were so many instances in which you had no warning that things were about to go bad. whether it was drugs or psychiatric issues, an angry family member who didn't feel as if you were doing a good job for their family, or just someone who was angry at the world and saw you as a great place to start exacting revenge. You know, very quickly, the situation goes from just a normal 911 call to a full-blown fight in someone's house. You're not really sure how you got there, but that's where it went. And you know, that was one of the first things that you begin to, you know, peel away about what it is. And of course, among others, was, you know, the people that we worked with. I think you just assume that everybody is a hero. But of course, you get into a job like that and you realize that you have a lot of people who are working a job, a really difficult job. And they're very good at it and they're passionate about it. But you know, that doesn't make anyone a hero one way or the other. They're people like the rest of us. And they, you know, we all, you know, occasionally make mistakes. And there are some people who shouldn't have been in the job who were. But I suppose like any other segment of society, you had people of all levels.
Well, I assume there's some level of adrenaline rush and exposure to trauma that probably takes its toll after a time.
It does. And, you know, that's part of what, there's a sort of a new movement to try to educate people who are coming into the field about what it really means to work emergency medicine. You know, just as often as you will work a gunshot, you'll be asked to sit very quietly in an old woman's house and hold her hand and talk to her because she has a headache and she lives by herself and she needs someone to comfort her. You need to be able to move seamlessly between those two calls because they will come one after the other and you'll sort of float back and forth and you never know which will be which. And in that regard, it becomes this very strange roller coaster of a very slow day where nothing happens and then bam, all of a sudden someone is hit by a car and your day, you know, sort of, it's like, you know, a bullet ricocheting off the wall. You take this different trajectory and then trying to come down off that and do your next call, which may require you to be very meticulous and take a very studious approach, you know, trying to determine, is my patient having a cardiac emergency or a respiratory emergency? Because they oftentimes look like, and you've got to be very calm and approach them, you know, in this very cerebral manner. And that's tough to do when you've just come off this call where, you know, you had an 11-year-old who was hit by a car, and now you're here, and you're still hungry because 2 hours ago you got called out for someone with a toothache, and so you didn't get a chance to eat lunch, and it's raining. And trying to, all these factors are coming together, and there's someone chirping in your ear on the dispatch radio saying, hey, you guys have been out there for a long time, hurry up. You know, it's hard to put all that sort of into its proper mental compartments and so that you can be healthy and functional and be a great medic over a career that spans years or decades.
Yeah, and what became pretty apparent, even with the training, and I'm sure the training was thorough as could be, there's no real training for actually getting out there and doing it.
No, there isn't. You know, if you imagine a doctor, you take a physician, she goes through her 4 years of medical school, decides, hey, I want to work in an emergency room, does a 3-year residency under doctors, where each year she takes on larger and larger roles until finally, after having done 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency, she's prepared to then be a doctor. As an EMT, you get 6 to 8 months of school, and they put you on an ambulance, and, you know, sort of you are waved off and say, okay, go and do good and great things. And you have to learn it on the job. You have no choice. And, of course, your partner, who knows, you know, maybe he's been a paramedic for 3 weeks. Maybe he's been a paramedic for 3 years. You have to hope that he knows what he's doing because you certainly don't in the beginning. You know, I know that there's certainly some trial and error out there as people are trying to find their footing and figure out, you know, how to work this really difficult job that always seems to take place in the worst circumstances.
Your own personal story was after you graduated as an EMT, you did immediately go to work for Grady Hospital, and you worked for a private ambulance service for a while, and that was sort of an eye-opening experience with varying levels of dedication and some pretty interesting individuals who were sort of, you know, some good and some really not very good.
Yeah, no, there's no other way to put it. To work at a place like Grady, you really have to be a great medic, and you have to be very dedicated to what you're doing, and there's nowhere to hide. Everybody sees what you're doing. The doctors know how you're treating your patients. And so if you aren't good, you will not last. And that's like that at a lot of EMS places. And so you have this sort of group of people who have, for one reason or another, not really made it at a 911 service. But they still have a job, they still have numbers, and they wind up in these private services. And essentially what they are, if you live in a nursing home or you're at home and you need to go to and from an appointment, these are the people who you'll call. That sounds like, well, it's certainly an easy job. But where the sort of catch comes in is that a nursing home kind of fudges its math a little bit. So if you have a fall, they will sometimes call the non-emergency number so that they can say to a family member, hey, it wasn't really a big deal. We didn't even have to call 911. We just called the non-emergency service. And they'll do that for a stroke or a fall, sometimes a patient who's in cardiac arrest. And they will try to make it seem as if, oh, this was something small that we caught early, and we just called this non-emergency service. And so you have these people who have washed out of the emergency system who are back in it, and they're not always prepared for the job. And you know, among them, you know, I had a partner who drank on the job, and I had some who really didn't know what they were supposed to be doing, who couldn't find a critical piece of equipment if they needed it, had you paid them. I mean, there was just no way. They were not prepared for that job at all. They weren't, in their mind, they were never going to have to run a critical patient. So when it happened, you know, it was a sort of complete disaster. And you know, we had, I mean, imagine all the reasons that people get washed out of a reputable job, you know, whether they're, you know, alcohol issues, drug issues, they're totally unreliable and show up for, you know, 3 to 4 days a week that they're supposed to be there. You know, they're not dedicated to their work. They're, you know, we had, there was a guy who used to slip off in an ambulance in the middle of the night to go find prostitutes. And, you know, it was a very strange, that was a particularly strange company. And I remember wanting to leave the second I got there. My wife said, hold on, just get yourself a new job before you quit. But remember that this is really weird and you're experiencing something that most of us never will.
Yeah, and yet you learned a lot. You were talking about how to hold an old lady's hand who's sort of not feeling well. And there was one guy at that service, he was kind of a bodybuilder type. He had this amazing ability with those old ladies.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You meet people of all stripes, but you know, there was a particular medic who I worked with who that seemed to be his specialty, you know. And from him, I really learned the importance of having that patience and that care for someone whose situation is not acute in any way. You know, those women that he sat there very kindly and gently and talked to and, you know, held their hands like that was the only reason that he was there, they weren't going to die. They really didn't need us, but they needed something, and he knew that. And that's part of the job. It isn't purely a question of science. It isn't purely a question of medicine. You know, EMS is this really strange throwback to sort of 19th century house call medicine where you practice your trade in someone's house. And you go to them, and because of that, it's a much, much more intimate experience than showing up at a hospital and sitting under 1,000 watts of fluorescent lighting. This is very personal, and you need to have a totally different approach. And he was the one who taught me that, and you know, I was really grateful for that experience because it's invaluable. And people need that. There are people who just need a caring, you know, caring voice on the other end of the room to sit down and smile and show that they are, in fact, important.
My guest today is writer Kevin Hazard. He's a former EMT and paramedic who's the author of 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. It's published by Scribner, documenting his, nine years as an EMT and paramedic?
It was.
And from that commercial service, you eventually went to work for Grady Hospital. But you were challenged pretty early on by, I guess it was somebody in an emergency room who you were trying to do something and it wasn't working out. And says, here, mind if I step in? And you said something like, oh, yeah, you're a professional. And they looked at you and said, well, what does that make you? And that really sort of changed your attitude, I think. Did it not?
It did. You know, I think I had entered into this for a lot of different reasons, but they were really about me. It was about, you know, me trying to broaden my horizons and get this greater perspective and be able to witness something that was vital and important and real. And it wasn't necessarily about being a great provider and really being a great medic and making sure that I was doing medicine the way that it ought to be done. And when we brought that patient in, he was another paramedic who was working in the hospital, and it was clear that I was not doing what I was supposed to be doing. And he was just trying to be helpful, to say, hey, let me give you a hand. And when I jumped back like that and said, hey, well, you know, you're the professional, go ahead, he was really taken aback and I think really offended because he took pride in his job, and he's looking at me thinking, well, if you're not taking pride in your job, you shouldn't be here. And that was the first person to really point out that, hey, this isn't about you. This isn't about you going out and gaining experience and sort of being inside this incredible movie. You know, these are people whose lives are on the line, whether they're really going to die or not. You know, these are people who are going through these important moments, and you need to be engaged, and you need to take your role seriously. And luckily, that happened for me early. You know, sort of a wake-up call that, hey, you know, this is an incredible thing that you need to be a part of.
And then you had a partner named Chris who also had that sort of dedication to it, almost a missionary sort of view of what you were doing. And that really instilled a lot of professionalism and really just sort of, I'm going to do this job.
Yeah. You realize from working with different people that there are a lot of different reasons to work in EMS. You know, it's sort of a strange world and with weird hours. And, you know, there are people who get into it for any number of reasons. But there are a lot of them that, you know, they, since they were little kids, that this is what they've wanted to do. And they're, I mean, the sort of the missionary approach is certainly how you would describe them. And Chris was one of those. You know, he pointed the way for me. You know, he really showed me the path that you need to take. And, you know, he, to this day, this is what he does. He's in the back of an ambulance. And he wouldn't have it any other way. And it was good that I encountered people like that early in my career that kind of said, hey, this is where you need to be. Because there are some people who didn't have the benefit of that. And some of their early partners were very burned out and jaded. And, you know, that's sort of leaves a stain on your psyche that's very hard to scrub out.
Yet that's sort of the cycle for a lot of EMTs and paramedics, is it not?
It really is. It's a, you know, it's a tough job, and it isn't like working in a hospital for any number of reasons, but, you know, EMS workers are not coddled in any way. Any job where someone can take 3 nights a week, night classes, and be part of the career field, there isn't as much security, because somewhere out there there's a manager who's saying, if you don't want to do this job, we'll get somebody else who can. And that sets up a strange sort of world in which the employer holds all the cards, and which is, you know, not necessarily the worst thing, but when you have people who are doing such an incredibly difficult job, many of them making as much as they could make at Starbucks, you know, who are working nights, holidays, weekends in the rain, who are being bled on or vomited on, whose patients are punching them, you know, who risk deadly disease by needle stick, nearly get in a car accident every day, who witness people get shot and stabbed, and on whose skills theoretically can turn the lives of every patient they see, you know, it can really be a tough thing. And you know, those EMS workers really, they do need some help. They need somebody there in their corner backing them. And that isn't always the case. And so it's just sort of all these factors combine and to make this job a tough one. You know, I mean, I had times where I was really on a high and I loved it and I couldn't get enough. And then things would happen and you kind of take a downturn. And then you would either work with someone who was great or you'd run a couple great calls that would bring you back again. And, you know, you kind of, people always said you'll burn out and then be reborn multiple times in your career. And I found that, I definitely found that to be the case.
Yeah. Well, you recount lots of stories, some horrific, some very funny. What was the most unusual call you went on?
Wow, you know, there's a lot of the more unusual ones become very X-rated very quickly because
yes,
people do very strange things. But
well, I was thinking of death by broccoli.
Yeah, that's, you know, that is without a doubt one of the, you know, one of the ones that stands out. That was a sort of a typical case of a bit of a miscommunication. We got called out for what we assumed was a cardiac arrest, and of course it was Thanksgiving, and most of these major holidays wind up with you working at least one death. I mean, just sort of the way it goes. You have all these families that are coming in from out of town and getting together, and it's great for a few days, but then after a while, all those old animosities spring up and people start to argue, and because you're out of town and on holiday, maybe you don't bring your medicine, and, you know, things just sort of unspool very quickly. But that one was typical. It was a family, two sons were arguing with each other, and, you know, grandma sort of put her foot down and in the middle of dinner to stop this, what had been 3 or 4 days of bickering between these two guys, and she choked on a piece of broccoli. Nobody knew that, or at least didn't tell that to us. And we got there working what we assumed was a cardiac arrest, only to find out partway through that she'd actually, you know, choked on this piece of broccoli. And, you know, by the time we got it out, it was, you know, it was simply too, you know, it was too late. And, but that was the first one of those that I worked. And witnessing that and watching that whole thing unfold, which, you know, you come over time, you come to realize is such a common occurrence. It was eye-opening to watch someone die and watch all the attempts that can be made to try to bring them back. And when we got to the hospital, we had allowed a family member to sit in the back of the ambulance with us. And she pulled me aside, and I felt terrible, you know, because we had not been able to get this woman back. And she, you know, sort of very glassy-eyed and quiet, just put her hand on my arm and thanked me. And it was a feeling like nothing I had ever experienced, you know, when you realize that it means a lot to these people, even if you aren't able to save someone, that you worked so hard to get it done and that you put so much effort into it. You know, there's something to be said for when it's all done and the sums have been tallied up, to know that someone's life mattered. And for six strangers to come bursting into your house and throw thousands of dollars of equipment and 250 years of medical expertise into saving them, you make perfectly clear that life matters. And people respond to that.
If you can make one change about how the system goes in most American cities today, what would it be, you think?
I think that they need to standardize training and hiring practices. If you look at police officers, there's a reason that cops are, you know, have this sort of universal respect. You know, all things happening right now, notwithstanding, firefighters and police have a long history in the U.S., and they continue to do so. And I think a lot of it has to do with training and hiring practices. People know exactly what the job is. They know exactly what's expected of them. And by and large, when you deal with a cop, you have some concept of exactly what you're going to get. And that isn't the case with paramedics, and it hasn't been. And some of it's because it's so new. Nobody really knew what to do with it. But I think with standardized training and teaching people that when they come in that, hey, a lot of this is going to be you sitting quietly in the home with an 85-year-old woman holding her hand through, you know, what is not in any way outwardly exciting. And, you know, getting people to understand that going in and improving their attitude, I think, would go a long way toward how people perform the job and how people who, and, you know, how EMS workers are perceived.
It really is a sink or swim sort of mentality when you go out and actually get out on the job.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, you know, you can study for years, but if you can't get that knowledge from your head down to your hands, it's not going to do you any good. And there are a lot of things that need to happen very quickly. And if you can't make that transition and you can't sit in a room full of people who have nothing in common with you, who speak in an accent that is not like yours, who use words that you don't normally use, you know, whose value system is completely alien to yours, if you can't learn from all the previous times you've been in their neighborhood and understand what they think in a non-judgmental way, put yourself into their shoes, and then do that in a convincing enough way that they look at you and say, all right, this guy understands. He's not us, but he's part of us. He's part of this whole system, and we trust him. If you can't do that, then you will never succeed in that job.
Well, it's an interesting book, 1,000 Naked Strangers. Kevin Hazard, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Former paramedic Kevin Hazard speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the author of 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.